all right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. No matter what anybody else says, that's who I am, and I'm sticking to it, all right? So there you are. All right, today's show is going to be packed, so I'm going to jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Fred Peabody, the director of a film called All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. Before that, we will be talking with Revolution Club members Travis Morales and Riley Ruiz, who have been at Standing Rock in North Dakota this past week. And that's people are following that. That's where the heroic actions of the resistors at Standing Rock in the face of escalating police attacks, armed company thugs, and government lies at all levels have put a spotlight on how this country is founded on the genocide of Native peoples and slavery. And we're going to be talking with Riley and Travis about all of that and what they've seen and what they're doing there. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing you an interview I did. Well, actually, it's the first part of an interview that I did with Heather Ann Thompson, who's written the first definitive history of the 1971 Attica prison uprising. Her book is just incredible. It's called Blood in the Water, and it tells the story of the uprising, including in all aspects of it, including the state's savage response to the prison uprising and the prisoners' decades-long struggle for justice. So without any more to do, let's just hear that interview now. On September 9th, 1971, nearly 1,300 prisoners took over the Attica Correctional Facility in New York. Holding guards and civilian employees hostage, the prisoners negotiated with officials for improved conditions. Shortly after the rebellion began, the prisoners issued a statement to the world about who they were and why they rebelled. L.D. Barkley, a member of the Black Panther Party and one of the leaders of the Attica Rebellion, read the demands and the prisoners' statement.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971. But of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard of the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to the situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who enslave and exploit the people of America. Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct federal jurisdiction. We want a governor and the judiciary to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite other people to come here and witness this degradation so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want.
And while prison authorities kept telling the world that the prisoners were torturing and threatening the lives of the guards they held captive, the guards themselves told a different story, the truth.
What is your name, please?
Frank Droll.
What is your job?
Correction officer.
Now, we want to know exactly what do you think of the way you're treated in here by these men.
We all have been treated 100%. Been fed well, gave us blankets, slept on mattresses while they slept on the ground. Medication was given to us while they didn't get any. They took care of us first. We've been taken care of at least 100%.
How do you think these men should be treated henceforth?
I think they should be treated 150%. I know they have grievances. I know because I work with them. They've got grievances. I know these grievances. We have to tell those people out there about them.
We all wish we could be home. By we, I don't mean 38 of us. I mean all of us. All 1,538 of us.
But on September 13th, the state sent hundreds of heavily armed troopers and correction officers into the prison. They killed 39 men, hostages as well as prisoners, and severely wounded more than 100. Drawing from more than a decade of extensive research, historian Heather Ann Thompson sheds new light on every aspect of the uprising and its legacy. And she's done that in a book called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Heather, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Yeah. Well, I got so much to talk with you about because when I got your book and I started reading it and I thought, this is unparalleled. It produced a very powerful work, and it's one that's astounding, eye-opening, and enraging all at the same time. What brought you here? What propelled you to write this book?
Well, it was a bit of a strange path there. I was by training a civil rights historian and a historian of cities and the labor movement, and I was sort of casting about for a new project after I wrote about the Detroit uprising of 1967 and that city. And I had always heard of Attica as this really important civil rights event behind bars, and it intrigued me, and I thought I would explore that and write a history of this civil rights struggle behind bars, not having any idea that it was going to prove to be a 13-year journey because the state of New York did not want that story told. And also, it was a prison story fundamentally, and so it kind of took me into this whole new world of research about prisons and our criminal justice system. And I think doing the book fundamentally changed the kind of history that I did, and also changed me. It was quite an extraordinary story that I felt compelled to tell.
How did it change the kind of history that you did?
Well, I think prior to working on Attica, I had thought about civil rights, and I thought about sort of urban struggles, particularly of Black folks in cities like Detroit or New York, as sort of the story. And I didn't quite understand until I did Attica the ways in which the criminal justice system and policing and containment and the very apparatus that we see the least of, because it's sort of hidden, prisons are hidden from view, were so important to the way politics unfolded in the period after World War II. And so working on Attica brought me into the history of the criminal justice system in a way that I had not really predicted, and probably will be something I'll always work on, you know, something that I will always be really interested in, because I now understand the way in which policies of policing and policies of prisons are so instrumental into the way our country operates and to the way folks live in so many parts of our country.
The thing about this, though, too, is it really is like, you know, like you said, you had heard about Attica and things like that. And actually, I'm old enough to have been present, you know, in at the time of it happening, not at Attica, but there in the world. And I was a radical, revolutionary-minded student at the time. And I mean, it blew my mind. But I also, when I picked up your book, you know, I realized how little I actually knew. And I knew quite a bit. And in fact, one of the people you write about, Dacajuea, John Hill, was a friend of mine. And so I knew some things about it, but I didn't know anywhere near what you found. And you did this. I mean, it really was a hidden history. And for even for people who, like myself, think, well, we knew about all this. You know, you found some things. But when you found some of these records, and this was kind of enticing to me, because you found these records and you said, okay, but they were impossible to actually, you know, pick up and use very, you know, fruitfully, because they were all heavily redacted. And we've all seen those things you get from the government that says, and then they said, and then the next 10 paragraphs are blacked out. But you were actually lucky. You say you ran into two extraordinarily lucky breaks that changed everything in terms of writing this book.
Yes. So part of what you say is was so central to the book, which is that we thought we knew a little bit about Attica, but it wasn't until I really began digging that I understood that we didn't really know much, because from the moment that this uprising happened, the state of New York was there front and center trying to change the story of what happened to Attica. So we didn't really know why there had been so much bloodshed there. We didn't really know how so many people had died after their civil rights and human rights rebellion, and yet no member of law enforcement ever did a day of time or even a moment in a courtroom. And so I was trying to figure out that story. In other words, what is it about the story that we don't know, and what is it that the state of New York is really hoping that we don't find? How did I know they were hoping? Because every time I tried to do a Freedom of Information request, it was denied, or as you say, heavily redacted. And so I was forced to rely on, you know, a lot of different avenues towards that research. I had to obviously talked to the survivors a lot, which was really important. You know, of course, the folks in the prison, both the prisoners and the surviving hostages, had been trying to tell this story for decades. And so I relied on their stories. I relied on the lawyers a lot and all of the litigation that they had tried to file against the state. And I had sort of been poking around, but I still couldn't get at that story of cover-up. How is it so much trauma could have happened there, and yet again, no member of law enforcement was ever held accountable? And that's where, as you mentioned, I just happened upon this real stash of records that were, you know, placed in a room in the Erie County Courthouse, because I think there'd been a flood or some water damage wherever they had been before. And the person at the clerk's office allowed me to see them, probably not knowing how important they were, but they were very important, because in those records were documents from the grand jury that had investigated the Attica retaking and uprising. There were state investigative documents. There were depositions. There were really, really important documents indicating, first of all, what the state did at Attica, also what the lengths it went to cover up the carnage at Attica. And so once I had that, I think I was able to write a book about Attica that even people who lived it didn't quite know. That is to say, what was going on behind the scenes. And it's a deeply disturbing story about protecting law enforcement at the highest levels of government. And you get to hear from Richard Nixon in my book as he congratulates Rockefeller on the brutal retaking of Attica. He has one question, which is, was this a black business? And Rockefeller says, indeed it was. And that's all he needs to know to justify the fact that 39 men were shot to death, hostages and prisoners alike, and 128 were shot so brutally that they were permanently scarred and maimed. And so it becomes a story not just about the rebellion, although that's a profoundly important and encouraging story, but it's also a story about major repression and how it happened, how it worked.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Heather Ann Thompson. Heather is an award-winning historian at the University of Michigan, and she's written on the history of mass incarceration and its current impact for the New York Times, Time, The Atlantic, Salon, Dissent, and a lot of other magazines, as well as various scholarly publications. She also serves on the National Academy of Sciences Blue Ribbon panel that studied the causes and consequences of mass incarceration in the United States. And her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, was just nominated for a National Book Award. You know, I have to ask you this about the second part of that really remarkable thing that happened, too, because I was really struck by that. I thought the thing of finding these records and stuff was very important. But then you talk about somebody calling you up and inviting you to come and see something, and it was like this big warehouse or something full of, or a storage unit full of things that had been collected from inside the prison yard and inside the prison, which I thought, God, you talk about actually touching history, history that's been hidden and suppressed for so long. And here you have all of these things from, I couldn't describe what they were, whether they're bullet casings or they're bloody. In fact, yeah, you talked about L.D. Barclay's, one of the leaders of the Attica Rebellion, his bloody clothing left in there. And I thought, God, that must have been such a just mind blower to have to stumble onto that.
It was. I mean, you know, it didn't, I mean, that, so what you're referring to is that in 2011, it was the 40th anniversary of the uprising. And I was, of course, still working on the book, and I'd done an op-ed in the New York Times about it. And meanwhile, the state police in New York, probably again, some hapless person who didn't quite understand the importance of Attica and its current resonance, gave to the state of New York's museum a 30-foot Quonset hut, military hut, full of Attica artifacts. And what that was all of the things that had been in the prison on the day of the retaking that the state police had scooped up, hoping to use as evidence against the prisoners. And it had been sitting for 40 years in this barracks in upstate New York, handed over to the New York State Museum. And because I'd done this op-ed, they called me and said, could you come and tell us what we have? And of course, I immediately went. I was incredibly interested to see. And it wasn't so much that it changed the story, you know, as those records in the courthouse did, but it certainly humbled me as to the importance of this story and the trauma that the prisoners had suffered at Attica. There were, as you mentioned, the bloody clothes of prisoners who'd been shot to death and also the hostages who'd been shot to death. And, of course, my own records indicated that the state knew it was going to kill its own hostages. And so you just to sit there and hold those items was really emotional. And to pick up the pictures of prisoners' children that guards and police had just ripped out of the cells and torn up. So it wasn't, again, that it really changed the story, but it certainly made me understand the viciousness of the retaking of this prison rebellion, and also the violence visited upon prisoners and hostages alike on that awful day on September 13th, 1971.
Those things, too, to me, they infuse what you write there. I mean, I felt like you put the reader, you took history and put somebody who's interested in history, just checking this out for the first time, or somebody who knows about it, and you put us right in the middle of something in a way that we could actually feel this. And I think that was, you know, part of being infused with the what you found in that Quonset hut. You get a sense of a living sense of history, which is it's very important in relation to this book, especially in relation to now and what's going on in prisons in relation to all that now.
Well, I'm grateful. I hope that is true, because I will say that, you know, one of the things that readers will feel, I think, when they read this is that, I mean, there's certain parts of the story that are so overwhelming in terms of, for example, in the beginning, the unity that these guys experience, you know, to stand together across barriers of religion and barriers of race and language and stand together for basic human rights. I mean, that is a humbling story. And then the story of the retaking, which is so violent. And you know, I think it's hard to convey those stories. And so I feel like, you know, if readers can feel that as if they were in it, then I'm deeply grateful, because that, you know, I sort of feel like I wanted to take them along with me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I was perpetually moved by the story, even as I was writing it, for sure.
Well, let's talk about this. In your study of it, you know, it's kind of interesting, because you present this as like, you know, you're looking at this thing and the prisoners are going through, you know, whatever's happening. More or less, you get a sense of the routinism of being harassed and tortured through your daily life, you know, in terms of the kinds of things that people are getting beaten up. They're getting thrown into cells. They're getting, you know, locked down for reasons they don't even know. And all of a sudden, out of all this comes a very shaky moment where nobody's quite sure what's happening, what's going on in terms of the relationship between the guards, and are they going to be brutally attacking them, or what's going to happen? And so people go to breakfast, they come back, all of a sudden the whole world turns upside down. Let's talk about that. What did you learn about what actually led to the rebellion?
Well, what I learned was that I think that Attica has lived on in public memory in really powerful ways as this sort of planned insurrection to stand together for human rights on the one hand, or the negative of that is the state of New York's version, which is it was a planned insurrection, meaning a conspiracy. And my research indicated that neither were quite true. It turns out that the guys in Attica had indeed been hoping and asking and really begging for better conditions. And they'd also been educating themselves and organizing in study groups in the yard. But the day that this all jumps off, it was actually down to a prison management decision. They had the upper level prison administration had decided on that one morning of September 9th, 1971, to retaliate against prisoners for an altercation the night before by refusing them entrance to the rec yard, which meant locking them in this hallway with the guards who were taking them back from breakfast. But of course, they never told the guards either what was happening. And in that sheer panicked moment where the prisoners think further retaliation's coming, the guards have no idea what's going on. People begin to back away from each other, arming themselves, and then quickly it becomes a melee and confusion and really what I describe as a riot. That is to say, chaos and violence. And it just so happens that a key gate that kept that tunnel from the rest of the prison gave way, thus opening up the prison to these men and thus opening up the prison to the rest of the prisoners. And so that is chaotic. It wasn't planned. But here's what is remarkable, that out of those moments of chaos and violence, and, you know, indeed one of the guards gets completely overrun and beaten, and he will eventually die of his injuries. I mean, it's no joke, the level of chaos and fear and violence. But then the guys decide that, look, you know, this is an incredible opportunity to tell the world what, in fact, goes on behind bars. Of course, Americans are completely shut off from this universe, that they fund, that is in charge of other human beings. And these guys knew that. And so they go to the yard and they quickly set up a really remarkable experiment in participatory democracy. They elect representatives out of each of their cells. They set up a tent city of a medical station and a food station, and they invite the media in to see their conditions and to see what they need to improve them. And they invite observers in to help negotiate with the state. They have hostages who are guards and civilian employees whom they protect over the course of what will be 4 days of negotiations for basic human rights that my book reveals were really an extraordinary moment in American history of unity, but one that will be dashed when the state of New York decides on a brutal, forcible retaking with state police officers who have been out there for 4 days, angry, passing out weapons indiscriminately, who are going to storm the prison. And that's when the bloodbath really begins, one that the state of New York knew it was about to affect. And so it's a story of highs and lows, for sure.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Heather Ann Thompson. Heather is an award-winning historian at the University of Michigan, and she's written on the history of mass incarceration and its current impact for The New York Times, Time, The Atlantic, Salon, Dissent, and a lot of other magazines, as well as various scholarly publications. She also serves on the National Academy of Sciences Blue Ribbon panel that studied the causes and consequences of mass incarceration in the United States. And her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, was just nominated for a National Book Award. You know, one thing that really struck me, too, is that when you're talking about what happened, what emerged among the prisoners, I thought that was actually really, that was phenomenal. It was really great. I mean, this whole idea, and it was captured, I think, in a little bit of a way by, I think it was L.D. Barkley who was reading the statement, reading from a statement that the prisoners put together, which said, began with, "We are men, we are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such." And you look at that, and you juxtapose that with what these guards and the people who are running the prison and, you know, from Rockefeller on down, and what's happening with that. And frankly, from Nixon on down, who's talking about all the things that you were just saying about, you know, this is a black thing and it's, you know, whatever this is. And these people are really, you know, they're criminals and they're gangsters and they're always going to be that way. They're just one step above animals, if that. And that you have this thing developing in the yard where you actually have people coming up and they're debating and learning things. And yeah, there's still, you know, there's some rough edged people there, but there's also people who are striving in ways that I thought got concentrated, really, really intense ways, got concentrated in what you were just saying about how they actually took care of people, of the hostages that were held.
Well, that's right. And I think one of the most heartbreaking stories that is part of Attica is the way in which the prisoners believe that the state will at least value its own people, right? Its own employees, its guard employees, its civilian employees. And they count on the state's humanity to help them have these negotiations. And what is really clear is that if it comes down to taking a stand against black prisoners, of course, it wasn't just black prisoners. It was white, black, brown. But the state understands this as a black insurrection. And it's really clear that they will sacrifice anyone if it means effecting control. And that, there's just these moments in the book where the men are crying. I mean, they are weeping. They can't believe the level of brutality that is visited upon them. In fact, one of them later testifies, you know, something, it's in the book, something, to the effect of, you know, as he's on the ground and there's a gun pointed at his head, and there's blood everywhere in the water and people are screaming and dying. And he looks up and he says, "I've never seen that much hatred in blue eyes." And this is the trooper who is just, and sort of, it's in this moment when you really realize that, you know, this question of humanity and who was more humane is completely upended. And I hope that readers are asked to kind of really rethink, well, who do we imagine is behind bars? Who do we imagine those people to be?
All right, welcome back. That was an interview I conducted with the author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. And her name is Heather Ann Thompson. And that was part one of the interview I did. And we will be presenting the second part of this interview next week. So stay tuned for that. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. So stay tuned. Hey, hey, ah, way, ah, hey, ah.
miracles we get. Moonlight fires our kindle, sending it back. We just make it go back.
All right, welcome back. That was Stomp Dance from Robbie Robertson, and it was taken from his album Contact from the Underworld of Red Boy. Now, we've had quite a difficult time hooking up with the members of the Rev Club that are out there in Standing Rock, but we've finally been able to do it, and they are joining us now. Travis Morales and Riley Ruiz, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing a little better now that I'm hearing your voice. You're at Standing Rock. How long have you been there? What are you doing there? What brought the two of you there?
We've been here a week, and we came here to stand with the people who are standing up to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline, this pipeline that it has the potential to poison the Missouri River and poison the Standing Rock Sioux people. And we've come here to stand with people, but also to give voice to people, allow people to talk to the world about why this has to stop, why this pipeline must be stopped, and why people should come here. And we've also come here to talk to people about this revolution, that the world doesn't have to be this way. We could actually make a revolution to get out of this, and we've been spreading this document from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party, how we can win. That's what we're doing here.
I want to get into that in a little bit, but one of the things I wanted to try and talk with you about first, before we get into that, is there are some pretty important and significant things going on there. This resistance of the people at Standing Rock is important in a number of ways, and I know you guys have written about this. Can either one of you speak to that now?
Okay, so yeah, we have been on the ground now for about a week, and we've met all kinds of people from all over the world, people who have put their, you know, regular lives on hold to be here, people who planned on being here for just maybe a couple of days or a week, who've stayed here for months. And there was a particular confrontation that happened yesterday that was really intense and really righteous, what happened the day before yesterday, where at Turtle Island, which is an island that DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, has occupied, and Native people were telling us that there are 12 burial grounds, sacred burial grounds on this land. And like I said, DAPL has occupied this land, and it's right on the edge of the main encampment. And so people righteously decided to go and try to get back that land. And people went unarmed and went over and had built a bridge across there, and to go and to try to get back that land and take over that land. And people went into the freezing cold waters after police had tore down that bridge, went into freezing cold water to demand that their land be given back to them. And one person just bravely decided to go do this, and then was followed by, ended up being about 50 people that did this. And this got national coverage, and there were police in riot gear macing and firing rubber bullets at these unarmed water protectors in the water. People, there were Native Americans who were in canoes who were going back and forth delivering blankets and coats and water and food to people. I mean, this was just incredible. The cooperation, the determination of people to do this, and up against twice as many riot police who couldn't even handle the mace when it got blown back in their face. I mean, they stepped back, they were falling apart. But anyway, it was a really, really incredible thing to see and to be part of, and to be able to document for people all over the world to see. And there's interviews also on revcom.us that people should read from the people who are part of this.
Now, Travis, in a way, there's a lot of things that are unprecedented about what's happening there. Particularly, even if you're just looking at the last 40 years, it's unprecedented. But there's actually more than that. As I understand from reading what you and Riley have written, and again, I want people to remember that you are members of the Revolution Club and that you went out there as members of the Revolution Club. And so you're joining with people that are taking up the struggle. And you're also doing what you said earlier, bringing revolutionary science to this. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I wanted to find out from you this unprecedented character of all these people coming together. There's different nations of Native people, and then there's people who aren't Native at all but are coming from all over the country to stand with them. Let's talk about that a little.
Something like 280 different tribes, indigenous tribes in this country, have come out in Canada, have come out in support of the Standing Rock Sioux, demanding that this Dakota Access Pipeline not be built. And within that, something like 200 of those tribes have been represented here at Standing Rock. And this is unprecedented. At no time in history have this many tribes come together. And within that, tribes, you know, that have historic beefs with each other. For instance, the Crow, who have historic conflicts with the Standing Rock Sioux were one of the first tribes to come out in support of them. So this has brought together all kinds of Native peoples from across the country and across the world. We talked to indigenous people from Panama, from Bolivia, who have come here. And it's brought people from all over the world to stand, not just people from this country, but we've talked to people from New Zealand, an indigenous person, I believe they're called the Maori, from New Zealand, people from Australia, Austria, Germany, Norway. This is gathering worldwide attention that people are standing up here to stop this pipeline and to stand up to this concentration of genocide that's been perpetrated against the Native peoples for 500 years.
Tell me this, man, because exactly what you were just talking about, and one of the things this has done is it's really shined a spotlight on the whole history of what has been done to Native peoples for centuries on many levels, to the people themselves, to the destruction of the environment that people are living in and depend on. This is unprecedented, reaching back to and revealing the genocidal history of what's been done to Native peoples here.
Right. I mean, this we're not that far. I forget the exact distance. We're not that far from the site of the 1890 Wounded Knee Massacre, where 300 Sioux people who were unarmed, who were involved in the ghost dance, were shot down and murdered. And this genocide has continued to today with their attempts to build this pipeline, which has serious potential to contaminate the water that the Missouri River, on which these people are dependent, and many people downstream are dependent. This is part of the continuing genocide, and people are cognizant of this, and they're standing up and saying, no, this is not going to happen.
Let's go to Raleigh for a minute here. Raleigh, tell me this. You were mentioning the pipeline and what's been happening overall. The devastation of the environment, that's been a big part of what's going on. Actually, as I understand it, one, it's threatening to totally destroy the water supply for the Native peoples, but it was moved originally from where it was going into cities, one of the big cities in North Dakota. It was moved because they were afraid it was going to threaten the water supply there. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. People are very outraged at this. People understand, well, wow, it was a problem when it was potentially going to go through Bismarck, but it's not a problem when it's going to go very, very close to Native land and potentially threaten their water supply and just completely poison their water supply, which could ultimately lead to just total devastation of this whole people, this whole tribe. And this is part of what has compelled so many people from all over the world to come here. People are connecting this up with the whole devastation of the planet that is going on right now, the implications if this pipeline is allowed to go through here, and how this could further advance these kinds of things happening. And people are putting their bodies on the line to stop this. People from all over the world, because, yes, people are understanding. When we ask people, why are you here? They say to stop this pipeline, but also this is about humanity as a whole. People are really understanding that, making these connections, that if this isn't stopped, if these kinds of things are allowed to continue, then, you know, somebody said the other day, the planet could go on, but even as it is being despoiled, but humanity, the ability of humanity to exist on a planet like this that is just being poisoned left and right, that is incredibly at risk. And this fight is a concentration of that.
Let's talk about the police presence for a minute so people get an understanding of how large and threatening that is.
Wow, yeah, that is something people do need to understand. Every night when we're trying to go to sleep in this incredibly peaceful encampment, right? Although there's people every night also singing and doing dances and this kind of thing, which is beautiful. But at the same time, you hear helicopters and planes overhead constantly. And anytime people go out onto the road, which is blocked now from burned out vehicles, but also from tanks, and National Guard and police have a constant presence there on this road that is not very far from the encampment. And they are constantly there. Anytime people come out onto this road to do a prayer, to do a walk, to do anything out on this road, they bring much more backup police. You see DAPL helicopters flying overhead at the same time as police helicopters fly overhead. I mean, yesterday when there was an action of clergy, about 300 clergy from all over the country, there were helicopters. It was just crazy. And you see these religious forces who are coming and praying and singing on this road. And then you have at the same time on the opposite end of the road, all these extra police forces coming in, the helicopters flying overhead. It's It is so outrageous.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Travis Morales and Riley Ruiz, who are two members of the Revolution Club who are currently in Standing Rock. So let's talk about this. You know, you're in Standing Rock. You're there. You're talking about all the things that have happened there. You're talking about the courage of the people, the determination of the people not to bow down in front of this continuation of genocide. But you also said in the beginning of the show that what's going on is you also came there to stand with the people and to be part of this, but you also came there bringing something. And in one of the articles you guys wrote, you talked about you're bringing revolutionary science to them. Let's talk about that, what you mean and what you're doing with that.
I mean, the main thing we've been spreading and getting out is this message from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party, how we can win, how we can really make revolution. And we've been getting out to all kinds of people from around the world, people who live here. And in getting to this question of, look, the world doesn't have to be this way. We could make a revolution. And this document is getting into how, not just why we need a revolution, but what we need to do now to get prepared and how we could actually defeat them. And we're getting it out to different kinds of people, and it's being spread by some people. I mean, we've talked to some different people who told us that they've seen this already, that a friend of theirs brought it to them. In fact, one youth was telling us that he'd gotten the pamphlet and he read the very first paragraph and let out a whoop, and his horse rose up on its hind legs and he dropped the pamphlet and the horse stepped on it, and he wanted to get another copy of it. And there's people that we've been showing this to and reading sections of it to them. And, you know, there's a real openness among people about trying to figure out how we can actually get out of this. And we've been bringing the people that, in reading this, getting into that we have the science, the leadership, and the strategy in Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, who's actually done the work. And people could go online and read about this, but also dig into this and dig into the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. How immediately on day one we would get into this. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of different responses. Some people have been extremely excited because they've never heard anyone actually talking about how we could get out of this, that there's an organization they can go online to revcom.us and read about it. Others, it's much more controversial. There is this question of violence and do we need to be prayerful. So there's been a lot of good back and forth with people, and in particular pointing to, look, what's going on here is a concentration of hundreds of years of genocide against the native peoples, the poisoning of the planet, which we've been talking about. And this is all part of a system that cannot help but do what it does. It cannot not do what it's doing here at Standing Rock. It cannot not poison the planet. It cannot not have its police killing Black and Latino people every day and deporting immigrants and conquering and bombing people all over the world. And we need to, you know, people who are questioning this and don't want to live in this kind of world, we're challenging people. Let's get into this and let's talk about what it's actually going to take.
All right, Travis and Riley, unfortunately, we have to go. We have another segment coming up, but I really wanted to thank you for joining us today. You're doing really good stuff there, and I really look forward to hearing more about it. Let's keep in touch, all right?
Right, and people should definitely go to revcom.us and read all the articles and interviews we've been doing with people.
That's right. They're very enlightening and very thrilling, actually. So take care, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Riley. All right. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
There is a war going on for your mind. Media mavens mount surgical strikes from trapper keeper collages and online magazine racks. Cover girl cutouts throw up pop-up ads infecting victims with silicone shrapnel. Worldwide passenger pigeons deployed paratroopers. Now it's raining pornography. Lovers take shelter. Post-production debutantes pursue you in NASCAR chariots. They construct ransom letters from biblical passages and bleed mascara into the holy water supplies. There is a war going on for your mind. Industry insiders slang test tube babies to corporate crackheads. They flash logos and blast ghettos. Their embroidered neckties say, stop snitching. Conscious rappers and whistleblowers get stitches made of acupuncture needles and marionette strings. There is a war going on for your mind. Professional wrestlers and vice presidents want you to believe them. The desert sky is their blue screen. They superimpose explosions. They shout at you. Pay no attention to the men behind the barbed curtain, nor the craters beneath the draped flags. Those hoods are there for your protection, and the meteors these days are the size of corpses. There is a war going on for your mind.
We are the insurgents.
All right, welcome back. That was There's a War Going On for Your Mind from the Flobots. All right, I recently saw a film, and actually I saw it a couple of times because I liked it. And the film is something that really is dear to my heart. As a journalist, I spent most of my life as a journalist, and a journalist who really was aiming to constantly reveal the truth to people about all kinds of different things. And this film is just about that. It's about a person who sort of personified all that, I.F. Stone. And the film is called All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. All right, and before we get into a conversation with the director of the film, Fred Peabody, I thought I'd give you a chance to hear the trailer. Check this out.
Every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
When is the last time you heard CNN say the Pentagon is lying?
You know, we don't have state media in the United States, but if we had it, how would it be any different?
I think the media is really nihilistic. It's about making money. What makes money in this country happens to be avoiding difficult truths about our society.
Thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down.
You have to get rid of this ignorant and meddlesome majority, control them, make sure they do the right things, all for their own good, incidentally.
Congresswoman, let me interrupt you just for a moment. We've got some breaking news out of Miami. Justin Bieber has been arrested on a number of charges.
Good journalism today has the state in its crosshairs, and you never want to punch down. You always want to punch up.
I would say our mission statement is to produce adversarial, fearless journalism.
The more power someone wields, the more journalistic accountability and scrutiny they need.
There are policies that have been enacted. There are bombs that have been dropped, as a consequence of which these millions of people are destitute in the way that they are. And we have to allow them to tell that story.
There's only two types of reporters. There's those who care and those who don't. Most of them don't care.
I'm amused at people who claim that the governments don't lie. Really? You know human beings that never lie? Of course they lie!
I tried to prove what I was saying from the horse's mouth, as it were, using the government's own documents.
I can draw a line from I.F. Stone directly to what I'm doing now.
I thought, how could the President of the United States be involved in something this dumb at the beginning?
We're being dumbed down, we're being watered down, and we're being told information which is false.
Make these people own this.
When the media acts as a conveyor belt for the lies, why it matters is because lies take lives.
I find in our own government documents nothing but lies.
All right, welcome back. That was the trailer from the film All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. And joining us now to talk about the film is the director, Fred Peabody. Fred, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
Give people a better sense of the film and then why you wanted to make this film, why you felt compelled to make this film.
Well, All Governments Lie is a famous quote by I.F. Stone, advice that he would frequently give to journalism students, you know, that you have to assume that they're lying and then go to the documents and find out if they are. Often he would find that when he did that, he would be able to expose the fact that the government was not telling the truth. And he operated this little four-page weekly, which he got subscribers to. I was one of them when I was 19 years old and a kind of would-be investigative journalist, doing freelance work occasionally for the CBC, CBC Radio in Toronto, where I was living. A friend of mine told me, you should subscribe to this little weekly. I.F. Stone's weekly, it's the only place you can read the truth about what the American government's really doing, especially in Vietnam at the time, but other things as well. So he is kind of a legendary figure to the current crop of independent, investigative, adversarial journalists today, like Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, who are co-founders of The Intercept investigative website, people like Amy Goodman, executive producer and host of Democracy Now! many other people. Michael Moore, as you know, is in our film and says he can trace everything he's done in his career to the fact that as a teenager he subscribed to I.F. Stone's Weekly. We have Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein fame, who was reading I.F. Stone's Weekly from the age of 11 because his parents subscribed. And he would get it first because when he got home from school, his parents were still at work, and there would be I.F. Stone's Weekly. So anyway, he grew up on I.F. Stone's Weekly. And what is it about him that inspires all these people? It's the fact that he was doing solid, rigorous, investigative journalistic work and exposing government lies, and in some cases, corporate lies. As then, the mainstream media today, you know, largely owned even more so now by gigantic corporations, just a handful of them, they're not doing that job, especially in a time of war or in the period when a government is trying to stir up support for a war, as we saw in Vietnam, you know, with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was what Johnson used to basically ramp up the war in Vietnam. I.F. Stone was the only guy to point out that there were a lot of discrepancies in the government story, and it appeared that maybe this so-called attack on a U.S. ship by Vietnamese PT boats didn't happen. But that was what Johnson used to get Congress to approve a major bombing campaign that ramped up the war in Vietnam. We saw the same thing happen in the run-up to war in Iraq, where even the vaunted New York Times was running planted false stories that had been planted in their paper by Dick Cheney, who then the next morning was on Meet the Press saying, well, hey, don't believe me. You know, look at the New York Times this morning. You know, Saddam Hussein is getting the parts to build a nuclear bomb. So as you know, we point out in the film that the mainstream corporate media are falling down on the job of keeping governments honest. And thank God we have independent journalists and outlets like Democracy Now!, The Intercept, a sort of younger-skewing internet program called The Young Turks, which is based in Los Angeles and created and hosted by Cenk Uygur.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, when I.F. Stone did this, it wasn't, you know, he wasn't a curmudgeon. He wasn't somebody who was just like, ah, the hell with that. I know this is, you know, I'm just going to see where I can poke around and see what comes up. But he actually got, you know, you got a sense that he got enraged. There's a scene in the film where I think he's talking to Dick Cavett and he's talking about the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And he's laying it out. He's saying, look, this is what's going on. You look at this and you have to, you know, if you're really looking to understand the world and what's happening, and if you need to have truth. At your access, you need to access the truth. And he was arguing that people have to do that. And that seemed to be a big thing with him. And this was no easy task. I mean, he did pay a price. For instance, although this was a kind of amusing price, he was banned from White House press conferences, which,
Yeah. Well, you know, not so much banned, but he just couldn't get accreditation. And, I mean, he was, you know, he didn't make a big deal of that. I mean, as he pointed out, because he was nobody running a small newsletter of any kind was given White House press credentials. So it's not that he made a big deal of that, but it is a fact. But as Noam Chomsky says in our film, and Noam Chomsky became a friend of I.F. Stone's and certainly considers him, you know, one of the best reporters ever. But as he said, that was probably an advantage for Stone because he didn't have to go there and listen to a bunch of lies from the White House press secretary, and in fact, instead went and read through Senate transcripts, Senate hearings transcripts, and, you know, the congressional record and other documents that he could publicly access, if you know where to look, and prove what was going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that was also very interesting about him, it's sort of, he was working in a time, and if you think about this now, there's two parts to this, but one thing, just observationally, there's, you know, he was working in a time where you make the point in the film where basically he had to do a lot of hard research. He had to, it wasn't something where he could just like fall into, you know, maybe he had a source here and there who would turn him on to something, but basically when it came right down to it, he had to go and dig into things, and he had to actually look for truth versus whatever's, you know, whatever didn't quite sound right. And he had to actually then do the work to search it out. And that was a pretty dogged amount of work. And he really had to have sort of a pit bull grasp on what was wrong here. Something was wrong, and I got to find the answer.
Yeah, he was a voracious reader. He would pore over, as I said, the congressional records, transcripts of hearings, but also the foreign press. You know, he was a big fan of I think, Le Monde and other French papers. And he read other, you know, European newspapers. I mean, he was, because he knew that they had a different take from the American mainstream news media on U.S. policies in Vietnam and elsewhere. And he had a voracious appetite for information, and he also had the skills of what he would have said at the time, you know, that he considered himself a solid newspaper man. That was the term that he used. I mean, today we would just say a solid journalist, but he very much believed in, you know, the importance of, you know, doing the rigorous, authoritative research, finding the documents, in some case, finding the sources within government, although he wouldn't go to the high-level sources. He would go to the people working away in the basement, at some government department who no one ever talked to anyway, and get the truth from them. Yeah, and plus he wrote with a great deal of style and wit, and that's the other thing that made his weekly such a pleasure to read. I can't stress enough how great and eloquent a writer he is. But also the human values come through. As Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept says at near the end of our film, you don't stop being a human being, and you don't stop caring just because you're a journalist. And as Chris Hedges says in our film, probably the most important thing about I.F. Stone is simply I.F. Stone cared. He really cared about people and about humanity.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Fred Peabody, who is the director of a really good new film called All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. Now, Fred, tell me this, man. It's interesting. The people that you brought onto there, one of the people that really I was attracted to, because it is somebody who is sort of down and dirty, and it's and kind of, you know, the style he has in as a broadcast journalist is jank, you know, and to me... There was something in what he did that actually captured I.F. Stone. When he actually went and he had that thing about being very excited about finally getting like an MSNBC job and, you know, then he was going to be able to do it. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Cenk had built up quite a following with his online podcast and videocast called The Young Turks, which he does now as well, and has tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of subscribers. Some of them paying subscribers and others who get highlights for free on YouTube. But, as you know, he was quite successful at that and obviously good on camera. So MSNBC offered him a job to host a major evening slot on MSNBC. I guess they should have known what they were getting was not a yes man and not a guy who was going to be a conveyor belt for government statements and take them at face value, but he was called in by the head of MSNBC, and this is after about 6 months, I believe, who said, Cenk, I've just come back from Washington, and they're not happy with your tone. I mean, this is because he had the audacity to ask tough, hard questions of politicians, you know, whether they were Democrats or Republicans. And at the time, I think he was also having the audacity to criticize President Obama for things that he considered not very progressive policies, and yet coming from a guy who seemed to hold out the hope of being progressive. So anyway, they said, you know, just tone it down and you'll be fine, Cenk. You know, they actually said to him, which is funny, act like you were a senator, which is mind-boggling, but... This is what goes on, even at a network that at the time was kind of portraying itself as mildly progressive.
Yeah, that is. It's funny, and it's also, it could be dangerous if you act like a senator or something. You could, yeah. Who knows?
Well, yeah. Well, as Cenk said, what does that mean? You want me to lie more?
empty my pockets. Empty. You know, get some. You got some big bags of money. And sort of. When the people talk about act like a senator, I always think of that. What was that one where they had the FBI had filmed all these senators and congressmen stuffing money into their pants, into their pockets many years ago. Abscam, right? Abscam. Yeah, that was it.
Right.
You just couldn't get funnier on it. We're running out of time, but I want to get one more point from you, which is tell people why you think that I.F. Stone, who has been gone for quite a while now, but I.F. Stone, why is it that people should pay attention to what he was and then also what he gave to the world?
I guess to me, I.F. Stone, ever since I started reading his weekly when I was 19 years old, has kind of been bedrock for the kind of journalism that means a lot to me. I mean, there's an old saying, and it didn't come from I.F. Stone. I don't know where it came from, but yeah, I relate to it, which is that, you know, journalism should afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. I happen to relate to that, and I think that is exactly what I.F. Stone was doing. He was trying to expose injustice and to do it in a way that was backed up by solid evidence. To me, that's the definition of good journalism, and people should know that even though they haven't heard of I.F. Stone, you know, some of the people, particularly if they're following some independent media online, some of these people like Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, Amy Goodman, Nermeen Sheikh, David Korn at Mother Jones, they all are doing what they're doing because in many cases they were inspired by the work of this little-known guy, I.F. Stone.
And
by the way, I want to stress that there are a lot of laughs in this film.
Yeah, definitely. I was just going to say that. All right. And the film is All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. And Fred Peabody, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Take care, man. All right. And as we go out, I should point out that the film All Governments Lie is currently screening in a handful of cities across the country and in film festivals here and around the world. But if you want to find out more about the possibility of getting the film in your city or your area, go to the website allgovernmentslie.com and see if you can find a way to get hold of the filmmakers and see if you can bring the film to your city, because you don't want to miss this one, folks. All right, well, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Kiana Williams, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with There Must Be a Better World Somewhere from B.B. King. Talk to you again next week.
Sometimes I wonder just what am I fighting for?